It is Tuesday morning on KAXE, and we strive to take an in-depth look at some natural resource-based issues important to our region. We hope to discuss not only the problems, but also highlight some creative solutions. And today, we are adding to our previous series on the decline of forest birds. Our guest is Dr. Ryan Norris. He's a professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of Guelph in Ontario to talk about the Canada Jay. Also joining us is our producer, Mark Jacobs. Welcome this morning. Thanks, Ryan. Thanks, Mark.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming. I'm thrilled to learn more. The gray jay has been one of my favorites, and for many years I lived among them and with them, and they have disappeared. I would have to consult my records, but it's probably been over 10 years since I've had a nesting pair anywhere near me. So curious to find out what's happening with our beloved friends. They are among my favorite birds because they're so insouciant, I guess.
Well, they're my favorite too, actually. Ornithologists aren't allowed to have favorite birds, but it's a rule from the American Ornithologists Union. But no, I'm just kidding. They are my favorite bird, and I love talking about them, and they're my favorite subject to talk about. I've worked on several different species of birds, but Canada jays are really my favorite.
I favor another member of the corvid group, but I am definitely in that camp. If they're corvids, they got to be pretty exciting to me. I want to run a couple things by you that I have heard about Canada jays, and before I want to learn all that I can, but I had heard, and you can disabuse me of these notions if that's the case, but I had heard that the Canada jay not only procures food and then coats it with the saliva and hides it, but that in the fall they will abandon some of their offspring and select one to remain with them that they will then try to feed through the winter. Is that a fact, or is that?
Well, not? you're kind of in the ballpark, no, but you have a few.
I'm eager to learn. Okay.
One, it doesn't occur in the fall. It actually occurs in June. And two, wow, it's not the parents that do it. It's one sibling that kicks out the other siblings.
Wow. Okay.
So what happens is there's a few really interesting things about Canada jays, and that is definitely one of them, this sibling expulsion. The other one is kind of intimately related to it, and that's the fact that they breed early. So Canada jays will start breeding in late February in most places. Of course, if you go a little bit further north, they'll breed a little bit later. But for where I am in Algonquin Park, in central Ontario, and where you are, they're going to breed around late February. So begin breeding the earliest ones. So that means that their young are leaving the nest in May, in usually like early May, late May. And this, of course, is when most birds are getting back. Most migratory birds are getting back and starting to breed. So they've got a head start. When their young are a few weeks out of the nest, that's when they start getting aggressive towards each other. In particular, one gets aggressive towards the other ones and basically kicks them out of the territory.
Wow.
The parents have nothing to do with it, surprisingly. They're bystanders. So the other two leave, and we completed a multi-year study actually to find out what happens to them and what their survival is. And we radio tracked them. I had a student, PhD student, that took the lead in radio tracking the nestlings. Well, we put the radio tags on when they were nestlings, and we tracked them in their first year of life. So the back to the one that kicks out its other ones. We call that the dominant juvenile, and it gets to stay with its parents for the over the first winter. It's not fed by its parents, but it does get to stay on the territory, and it doesn't leave until the next year when the other its new siblings have fledged the nest. So it gets quite it does get quite a good benefit from staying, and in fact it does have higher survival, about double the survival than its siblings that it kicks out. Now where is their siblings, where do the siblings end up?
Yeah, indeed.
Well, we kind of had an idea from the siblings that ended up within our study site, which is a big study site, but of course many of them disappeared and we didn't know whether they died or what happened to them. So we started radio tracking them, and we radio tracked them. We attached radio transmitters on them like little backpacks. And it's a common thing to do in birds.
Right.
And we flew over the park to try to get the ones that had dispersed off the territory. We canoed, we walked, we drove, a whole bunch of things. And found out that about, first of all, they have lower survival, not surprisingly. But of the ones that survived, about a half were adopted.
Ah, that I also had heard that.
They're adopted by breeding pairs who had unsuccessful breeding attempts that year. So if they did not fledge any young that year, they happened to have their nest depredated, then, you know, I wouldn't say they're glad to adopt a juvenile that has been kicked out of its territory, but they'll relent. You can think of it that way. They'll eventually relent. Other ones may find another younger bird to breed with, maybe an older bird to breed with occasionally, and some are just alone on a territory.
Is there any sexual preference? Is it a male that is the dominant one or a female, or do you have that data? Is that possible to discern?
Yeah, we have the data, and it's almost always male.
Is it?
The only time it's a female is when there's an all-female brood.
Wow.
It's going to be a female. So it's probably related to body size. Males are bigger than females. That's the way it goes.
Wow.
Interestingly enough, when you kick out your siblings, you incur a cost, of course, because, you know, it's something called indirect fitness. If you help out your siblings or anybody that's related to you, then you're increasing your fitness, in your indirect fitness, because you're related to the people you're helping out. So it matters, right? That's why we all help out family. But the opposite is true too. If you do harm to your siblings, you're decreasing your indirect fitness. But it turns out that in Jay's, even the dominant sibling decreasing its indirect fitness, it still comes out on top. Like, it doesn't suffer that much. It still has overall a higher lifetime fitness than compared to its siblings that it ends up kicking out.
Wow.
So
this is all fascinating, and I could go on talking about this for the whole time we have, but
sure, let's do it.
I'd like to know, what is leading to the decline around here? Is it habitat? What sort of habitat do they require? What are they lacking? How come they're not as prevalent here as they once were?
Well, of course, you know, being a scientist, I'd say, I don't know exactly where you are, what's happening,
right?
But
right.
I can make guesses. We've been studying them in Algonquin for longer than I've been on this earth for.
Wow.
So, and I'm 50. So, the Algonquin study has been going on for about 60 years.
Wow.
And through those data that we've accumulated, we have a pretty good idea of at least something that's causing the decline. Usually in animal populations, it's multiple things, right? And that's not never a satisfactory answer when you give to people. But it's always multiple things. But the main thing in Algonquin that seems to be driving the decline is warming temperatures in the fall. And even more specifically, freeze thaw events that when you have warming, you increase the number of freeze thaw events that happen. And what that is doing, as far as we can tell, is rotting cached food. And what that is doing, as far as we can tell, is not decreasing Canada Jay survival, the adults, but it's influencing reproduction, which, if you remember, I said occurs in the late winter, begins in the late winter. So in the late winter, when Canada Jays start breeding, they're still heavily reliant on cached food. And even when they're feeding their nestlings, they feed their nestlings about half cached food on average. So they're feeding their nestlings in April and, you know, pretty well into spring. But in places where Canada Jays live, like where you are, and in Algonquin Park in Ontario, April's April, you know, it's a shoulder season. There could be snow. There could not be snow. There's not a lot of fresh food around yet in the season. So there, you know, we found evidence that Canada Jays feed blueberries to their nestlings. And you can't find a fresh blueberry in April. So, I'm not saying that they feed them only blueberries, but we've done genetic testing on their poop, on their fecal sacs, and blueberries come out, and other things come out that can only be found in the fall. So, anyways, cached food is like, caching is the thing that kind of shapes what Canada Jays are in many respects. And they essentially use trees as freezers to preserve their food. But of course, they have to cache food at a time when it's not freezing, because that's when the food is available. So they're caching food in August, September, and it freezes, you know, depends where you are. It starts freezing consistently late November, December. So that's quite a bit of a time, you know, where the food, which is perishable, is sitting there and rotting, like degrading. It degrades through microbial action, and it's never as good as when you first stored it. But if the conditions are such that it's warmer and there's more freeze-thaw events, that's of course going to degrade the food even more. And food scientists know this. You know, they do all sorts of studies on freezing and thawing, the effects of freezing and thawing on food. And we've kind of dove into that literature as well as part of this research. So
their diet is primarily fruit. I mean, it seems to me, you know, they're always coming to, they always come to the camp and steal the bacon. Or the potatoes, or whatever's on your plate.
No. I mean, that was just an example.
Okay.
Blueberries was just an example of something that Canada Jays cache and then remarkably feed their nestlings 6 months later.
Wow.
But they'll feed on anything that's perishable. Like, they cache anything that's perishable. They're happy to cache insects, berries, meat from carcasses, handouts, of course, from people, mushrooms.
Is there something in their saliva that in this sac that they create that is preservative or antimicrobial?
We've asked that question. So first of all, the saliva gland in a jay is the largest of any bird given its body size. It's remarkable. One function clearly, though, in the saliva is stickiness. Like, we've had jays in captivity And they will just stick a piece. If you give them a piece of food, they will just stick it on the side of the cage, and it'll stay there. So when they're caching, they cache little pieces of food. You know, when most people think of caching animals, you think of animals that store food, all the food in one place, right? So, but the jays aren't like that. They're called scatter hoarders. They cache each individual item in a different place. So it's been estimated that they can cache maybe 10,000 things in one season.
Wow.
And each piece of food is in a different place. Usually, it's on a tree, in the bark, in the vertical bark, on a horizontal branch, different places on the territory. So that's the first thing. I forget, what did you ask again? Oh, the saliva. Yeah. I'm getting to it. So the saliva is used to stick because it's usually the piece of food's stuck underneath a bark flake. So you need it to stay there for a long time. But we have wondered about the saliva. And we did an experiment actually recently that we haven't published yet. I have a student that did it. When we catch a jay, you can to band it. We catch all our jays to band them and measure them, the adults and the nestlings. But when you catch an adult, you have it in your hand, and I'm holding up my hand like I'm on a radio. I'm on the radio, but I'm holding up my hand. You have the bird in one hand, and remarkably, you could give that bird a piece of food, and it will take it in its bill and not swallow it. And the reason is because a jay's instinct is to cache it. So it's saving it to cache it.
Wow.
But it will happily take it from you. Now, I thought, well, this is a perfect opportunity to test the effect of saliva on preservation, because we can give a jay a piece of food, let it coat it with its own saliva, and then we cache it ourselves. So that's what we did. And but it was kind of painstakingly, because you got to catch a bunch of jays and got to keep feeding it food, right? We did this, and we had two controls. We had a control with no saliva, and then we had a control where I had another student coat the same piece of food in his saliva. So
how do I get that job?
Yeah.
Oops, so swallowed that one. Sorry.
Yeah. And my student who was doing this experiment, you know, one time she was presenting it, I think, and showed the other student kind of like spitting on the piece of food. I said, yeah, don't show that. That's too gross. Don't show that in your presentation. But we found out something a little bit unexpected. So we thought that when we put these things out, that the food that would lose the least amount of weight over 4 months, we put them out for 4 months, would be the saliva coated, the Canada Jay saliva coated food. But in fact, that the food that was coated with Canada Jay saliva was the same as the control with no saliva.
Wow.
What lost the most amount of food was the human coated food, the food coated with human saliva. So to us, that what that means is not necessarily that jay saliva preserves food, but it doesn't degrade food like other saliva does.
Okay.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't have the degradation properties necessarily of other saliva. Now, we only used human saliva. It would be nice to use saliva from another bird that didn't cache, but that's next to impossible.
How do you get that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Here, spit in the cup.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Go ahead, Mark.
So that's a scoop for the morning show, huh?
Yeah.
Heard that here first.
Yeah, that's right. It's unpublished, so.
All right.
It's a big scoop.
We're speaking with Dr. Ryan Norris. He's at the University of Guelph, and he's an expert on Canada jays. I'm curious, Dr. Norris, I know from, I had an associate here for many years, a fellow by the name of Harry Hutchins, and Harry worked on Clark's nutcrackers and pinion nuts out in the West. And they determined through various methods of research that these birds were caching somewhat like 90,000 of these pinion nuts, and they would remember 90% of them. Does the gray jay have that same sort of recall?
We don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I've never brought jays into captivity, although I did mention a jay caching in captivity. That happened to just be one jay, but I've never done experiments on jays in captivity. Nor do I think I will. So I don't know for sure. This has come up quite a bit. Like, there's a rough estimate that Canada jays may cache 10,000 pieces of food. Mm-hmm. In a year, that could be an order of magnitude off. I have no idea. Could be 100,000. I have no idea.
Yeah.
There's two possibilities, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, I suppose. One is that they remember where they all are. And the second is that they put them in places that they're likely to look for later. And you can kind of think of that as like making foraging in the future easy. You know, if you land on a branch of a black spruce, a horizontal branch of a black spruce, and you're a Canada jay, you're going to then store that piece of food at a certain height above that branch in a piece of bark on that side of the branch, usually.
Yeah.
That's the easiest place to do it.
Sure.
So if I go to a bunch of branches and look at the right spot, 6 months later, maybe my foraging success is now like 50% or 40%. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's how they do it. Or they could do like a combination, like, oh, I remember where some of these are, but I'm going to go looking for the ones I don't quite remember. I don't know. I'm not sure. The challenge is being able to, like, doing it in the wild's impossible because you can't really follow jays,
right?
And determine where they've cached all their food. That would be impossible. So the only way to do it would be to bring jays in the lab. Now there's been a nice studies on other birds in the lab, like Florida scrub jays, you know, that have shown some remarkable things. For example, they retrieve food based on how different types of food based on how they degrade, you know, the rate of degradation.
Wow.
So I know this type of food will degrade faster, so I'm going to retrieve it first.
Huh.
And if Florida scrub jays can do that, I don't have any doubt that Canada jays can do it too.
Oh, they're way smarter.
Yeah, they're smarter, yeah.
I think we've just begun this conversation, but we are out of time. That's Dr. Ryan Norris, along with Mark Jacobs. And this conversation on the Canada Jay will be available at our website at kaxe.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Norris, man, I'd love to share a beer with you. I think we could. I would have so many questions. Thank you so much for being here. This was
really. You got to do a part two.
Yeah, indeed.
So. Yeah.
Sure, happy to do it. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. It was wonderful.